Nice to be here again. It's the first time I get to see this room. I hope I don't fall down there. So I will talk today about my most recent paper, and I forgot to put the reference here, but it's on the archive and it's not difficult to find. I have given this talk last week at a conference that was mostly populated by philosophers. So if I get too fluffy, then please, let me know in some way. So I'll be talking about dualities, which in the broadest sense is an identification between two theories. But it's particularly interesting if the two theories are very different from each other. And needless to say, I will only talk about the interesting cases. Dualities have a long history, but they have recently received an increasing amount of attention because of various dualities that have been discovered in string theory. So for the search for theory, for a fundamental theory of nature, dualities are really a game changer because they make us question what really is fundamental. If you have a duality that identifies two theories, then whatever is fundamental from the one side of the duality is emergent from the other side of the duality. So I think what this is trying to tell us that what we should think of as fundamental are not the ingredients of a particular theory like the fields or the symmetries and so on, but the underlying principle that gives rise to these theories that might be, for example, the path integral approach or quantization condition, additional assumptions like the stability of the vacuum, and so on. Okay, but I will not, yes.
I'm surprised you say duality when it's like a more fundamental building block than their expression.
Yeah, certainly you can look at it from
That
this
would be a very good
perspective.
change.
So yeah, so the sentence that I was about to say is that the question what the dualities mean for the fundamental theory is not what I'll be talking about, but I'll be talking about their practical use as calculational tools. Okay, so yes, this is the fun slide to wake you up. In a certain sense, duality is a type of unification, but it works in a different way. So it does not work by combining two theories that look different into one larger whole that has some aspects of one or the other, but isn't really neither. Like this unified snake duck is a little bit like a snake and a little bit like a duck, but not really either the one or the other. So duality works more like this. That's the snake-duck duality. So here you have the snake, and this is Daffy Duck. I realize that not everybody sees it by glimpsing at it at first.
Just assuming the one
You, you've, you've seen it before.
So we
Okay.
realize it's the
So
same.
here's the snake-duck duality. So it's really the same thing, just looking at it in a different
The
way.
more modern version is this dress that is blue or yellow or black.
Yeah, right. Exactly this
Yeah.
way. The
Yeah.
damn dress
I see the
that broke
reference.
the
No,
internet.
it's too late.
Okay, so the first thing that might come to your mind when you hear the word duality is the particle wave duality. And normally, if somebody starts talking about the particle wave duality, I tell them, well, that's the thing of the last century, right? When people thought, well, light can be both a particle and a wave, so there has to be a duality between the both. But now we know, of course, that the light really is neither particle nor a wave, but it's described by a wave function. This is all there is. In fact, I had a professor who said that we should get rid of the word elementary particle because there isn't any such thing as a particle. And he proposed that we call them elementary things. But of course, that sounds stupid, so nobody does it. So even though the particle wave duality does not exist in the sense that it was conceived maybe a century ago, you could still say, well, that sometimes the wave function looks a little bit more than a particle, sometimes it looks a little bit more than a wave. And of course, you all know what the Fourier transformation does on this function. So if you have something that looks a little bit more than a particle in position space, and you do a Fourier transformation on it, you get something that is very spread out in momentum space and the other way around.
Could you just think about particle wave duality as duality between like the Schrödinger picture and then the path integral, the wave function picture? The wave function is a wave, but then path integral picture is particle wave.
You could do it. Okay,
you
so
could do
that,
the algorithm.
don't make it too complicated. So the only thing I wanted to say with this slide is that if you take the Fourier transformation of a Gaussian wave package and you make it into momentum space, then the width of the thing is the inverse of the width of in position space. So I just wanted to remind you of this. And of course, this has really nothing to do with quantum mechanics in particular, just a property of the Fourier transformation. So a momentum space only comes in if you relate the dual space, so to say, to the momentum space, and then there's an H-bar in front of it. But what you should take away from here is just this reminder that the width goes to the inverse of the width if you go from momentum space to position space or the other way around. Oh, yes, and it's a very non-local relation. Okay, so here's an example that is a little bit less trivial and was, one of the things that got me to switch from mathematics to physics was the self-duality in electrodynamics. So the field strength tensor, so the F mu nu is as normal, the field strength tensor, so that's the exterior derivative of a one form, so it's a two form. And the dual form, the form dual to the field strength tensor in a space with d dimension is the number of dimensions minus the rank of the form. So in four dimensions, they are both rank two. So here's the field strength tensor and there's the dual field strength tensor. So what you can do in 3+1 dimensions with electrodynamics is to rewrite the path integral. So here's the path integral, the integral over all the one forms. And here is the action of the free field. And here's the coupling constant. It goes into the denominator. Now you can rewrite this into an integral over the field strength tensor instead. Then you have to put in an extra constraint. That's basically the Bianchi identity. And then you rewrite this delta function the same way that you would normally rewrite a delta function position space by putting in an exponential and an integral over this. And here you introduce an integration variable. So you have this integral over some variable v. And then this infinite product becomes an infinite sum. So it becomes an integral. And then there's still this normal term that you have from the action. So I've left out some steps here in which you massage this expression a little bit, do a partial integration, and rewrite this product. And what you do then is that instead of going back to this step by integrating out over v, you integrate out over f mu nu, and end up with this expression for the path integral in which you're now integrating over what you originally introduced just for the sake of rewriting this delta function. So it's an integral over v. And what was previously the field strength tensor is now the dual field strength tensor. And then you can show, if you look at the equation of motion that you get from this thing, that the dual field strength tensor is related to this variable that you have introduced in just the way that you would expect for the field strength tensor. So the important point that I want to draw your attention here is that the coupling that was here in the denominator goes up. It goes up for the same reason that the width of the particle in position space goes into the inverse of the width if you integrate out the Gaussian when you go to position space. So that's why I told you this. So what you have here is basically the coupling constant that goes to the inverse up to, you know, some pi's. Actually, I might have lost some pi's there, so don't trust me on this. Yes, and then I should probably add that since this is a free theory and it doesn't actually have any interaction, this coupling constant is not particularly meaningful, but you could add additional matter fields to this and you would still find the same thing. So the point is that the coupling goes into the inverse of the coupling. And if the coupling in the one case was a small number, in the other case it will be a large number. So that kind of duality is referred to as a strong weak coupling, strong weak duality.
So if you're putting coupling, you find the same thing, but you would exchange local coupling to
yeah, probably it becomes awkward, which is why nobody really works with this. Yeah, but I'm trying to make the case that, you know, a weakly coupled theory can have a strongly coupled dual theory. Okay, so. Yes, that's another example, but I don't know a terrible lot about condensed matter, so I know more about the exterior algebra than I know about the Ising model. Ising model. So now you know, you should know this, right? Okay, so yes, so then we get to the next more difficult step. The gauge gravity duality is an identification between the classical gravity and anti-de-Sitter space with the gauge theory on the boundary of the space. And this is also strong weak duality. If the gauge theory on the boundary is strongly coupled, then the gravity side is weakly coupled. The best understood case is N equal 4 super Youngmuir's with ADS5 cross S5. So if you know one thing about string theory, it's that they have 10-dimensional space. You need these additional 5 dimensions, but they are sometimes not mentioned because they don't actually do anything. So you can forget about this tensor product. You just have this 5-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space. There are some other cases with less supersymmetry that are known that are fairly well understood. It has not been proved that this duality is exact, but at least in these cases, there's very little doubt about this. Yes, and the reason this works is basically that ADS space is not globally hyperbolic, so what's on the boundary really does matter, and it's believed to solve the black hole information loss problem. And don't get me started on this because then I'll still be talking 2 hours. So now you might expect to see here this Escher drawing that is supposed to illustrate anti-de-Sitter space, and I decided to not show it. Instead, I have another picture that is supposed to show anti-de-Sitter space. So here is my sketch of anti-de-Sitter space. It's a box, and you have the information on the boundary. Yeah. Okay, so now then you might say, well, what's so interesting about having the information on the boundary? So if I go into a supermarket and buy a bottle of water, I also have information about what's inside on the boundary. Well, that's interesting because if you try to discretize your space, and that's really the easiest way to see it, then the number of things that you can do on the inside scales with the number of bits that you have in the volume, whereas what you can do on the surface scales with the number of bits that you have on the surface, which for large n is a much, much smaller number. And if you know that everything that goes on in the inside must be possible to describe what goes on the boundary, then you know that there are things that cannot happen in the inside that you expected would be possible to happen. So that's why this is surprising. What are dualities good for? Well, most of particle physics relies on perturbation theory. That's what you learn as a student. And that means basically you have free particles, possibly with some background field, and then they have a small interaction possibility. Then you go and expand the S matrix that I have sketched here very sloppily. So, of course, at every order, there would be very many diagrams contributing here. But the point is that at every order in the expansion, you have additional vertices, and so the power of the coupling constants that come in at every order gets larger and larger and larger. So if the coupling constant is small, then you have a good chance to expect that all these contributions will get smaller and smaller and smaller. So if you have a large coupling constant, then you have no good reason to expect that you can neglect all these dots that you have here. So all this is just to say that if you have a theory where the particles do not interact weakly, then perturbation theory doesn't work. What you need to do then is you need some non-perturbative approach, and these are difficult to come by. And now that's where the strong weakling duality becomes interesting, because what you can do then is you take your strongly coupled theory, you use your duality, convert it into a weakly coupled theory, then you do your calculation there, Then you take the result and convert it back into what you originally wanted to do. And that's basically what string theorists are trying to do with the gauge gravity duality. So that's why everybody is excited about this. Examples for strongly coupled systems that you might want to look at. Prominent examples are the quark-gluon plasma or nuclear matter at low energy generally. Quantum chromodynamics has the awkward property that it becomes weakly coupled at high energies, but in the low energy regime, like where we sit now, it's strongly coupled and nobody really knows how to deal with this. I will not be talking about the quark-gluon plasma, though, because I'm not too fond of these applications of the gauge gravity duality to the quark-gluon plasma. I'll, to the extent that I talk about it at all, I'll be talking about strange metals. So that's a class of metals that includes high-temperature superconductors. And so I'm not a condensed matter person. So try to find out what is a strange metal. So the first thing I can tell you is that a strange metal isn't actually a thing. It's a phase of a thing. So there are certain metals that have a phase that is called strange metal phase. So what's strange about them is that they have, for example, an unusual scaling of the resistivity with the temperature. And I found this plot here. So this is the resistivity. This is the temperature. And what you should be able to see is that it keeps growing. So this should not happen in a metal that is described by the Fermi liquid theory. So in this case, the resistivity should stagnate at some point. So this is one reason why these metals are strange. Another reason is, and this I find particularly useful to see why you can probably not describe strange metals with the normal Fermi liquid theory or in a superconducting regime with the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer model, is that whenever you have a metal that is described by the Fermi liquid theory, it has a Fermi surface, and you can measure this Fermi surface, and this is a measurement of the Fermi surface for some strange metal. Forgot what, it doesn't really matter. So in the Fermi theory, the Fermi surface can do a lot of things. It does not have to be a simple shaped thing at all, but one thing that it should be is a surface. And what you can see here is that according to these measurements, it's not a surface at all. You just get these disconnected arcs. And this is basically impossible to describe with the normal Fermi theory. So of course people have tried to figure out if maybe there are some connections here that they just have not seen, but so far they haven't seen anything. So what this tries to tell you is that you cannot describe these metals with a model that is based on quasi-particles. Yes?
Why do you like quark-gluon plasma? That is why you like kind of microsystems, but
Because at least near the quantum critical point, you would expect that conformal invariance is a good approximation, and I don't see why this is justified for the quark-gluon plasma. And then I have some particular problems with the. I also have some, you know, if you look at the data from RIC and LHC combined, it is very, very difficult to fit with the ADS-CFT models. And that would be a different talk, but I'm totally unconvinced by the papers that I've seen on this. You know, you can make the model more complicated by, you know, taking some strings that fall into the black hole and then do funny things. And then still it doesn't work well. Yeah, basically, and then it becomes very arbitrary, and even if you do this, it still doesn't really work.
Got a low viscosity, and that was a surprise experimentally. And then, and this duality
That's certainly what got everybody surprised. But then, of course, you don't stop there, right? So the next thing that they looked at were the... Right, so...
So theory, I think
the boxer is genuinely... Right, I guess the idea is that there are certain things that aren't allowed in the bar, and then that gives you those like inequalities. So I guess the idea is that there's a limit that physical things you can make in the bar. But yeah, I mean, if you could find those, then of course those would be generally interesting. But then I think that if you see some curve, you just... I think the aim of the game really is just build some... from a collision of black holes with some charges, and then add enough stuff that looks like what you see in the binder.
Yeah, I don't think they can do collisions of black holes. It's much simpler than this. You have a black hole, and then you let a string fall in, or one end of the string fall in, or whatever. But no, the point is that the viscosity kind of, you know, it comes out correct up to some factor that, you know, then can argue comes from God knows where. But the thing is that they looked at the transport coefficients for the jet quenching, where you have the energy loss of the particles when they go through the plasma. And that should depend on how strongly coupled the plasma is. And it also depends on the temperature. So at RIC, you have a different temperature than you have at the LHC. And so what they did first was, when they had the RIC temperature, they used the parameter to fit the RIC data. And then when the LHC data came out, it turned out that they couldn't do it both. Okay, so and then they went back and said, well, now you put something different in the bulk. And then it still didn't work. And then, you know, they said, well, then we do something else again. And then it still didn't work. And then in the end, they had some, I can give you a reference to the paper. It's this, the guy at Princeton, Gupser.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it has a paper where it then says maybe there's some uncertainty in how they measure the temperature at the LHC, which can probably be, you know, there must be some measurement uncertainty. And if you take this into account as well, then you might maybe be just about able to do it, okay? And at this point, I was like, you know, it's not particularly convincing, let me put it like this. And yeah, so anyway, all this was just to say that I would not be talking about the gluon plasma. Okay.
You said that there's no Fermi surface, maybe.
No, it's, how they did the measurement. Well, you take your superconductor, and this measurement method has a name that keeps escaping me, something with blah, 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 spectroscopy. So what you do is, I warned you, you know, I don't know a terrible lot about this. So you have your superconductor, and it's basically some kind of sheet, and then you shoot photons at it. And every once in a while, the photon will kick out an electron, and then you measure the momentum of the electron. And that's what's plotted here. Now, that's the brief summary of what my paper was about. So here's again the gauge gravity duality. It was discovered through a string gauge duality, so that's the more general thing that identifies a type 2B string theory in anti-de Sitter space with a gauge shield on the boundary. But then I told you that we're just doing classical gravity, so how does this come about? Well, you take the large n limit, and n is the rank of the gauge group, and if you ask a string theorist, then n equals 3 is a large number. So in this limit, the string theory becomes classical. And then there's something else called the Tuft coupling. If that is large, then the string effects are suppressed. It doesn't really matter for the following what exactly this means. The point is just that there is some limit in which it is really just classical gravity. And you have this duality between the classical gravity and the anti-Sitter space and the strongly coupled system on the boundary. Okay. So, as I told you, this duality has not really been proved, and certainly not for the application to condensed matter systems. So the point of view that I'm taking here is that this is a well-founded motivation to use gravitational systems as modeled for strongly coupled systems on the boundary. So this is a very phenomenological approach. You just use this duality that has been discovered to create some kind of system. Then you calculate the observables and you see if they fit with the experiment. And yes, and this is what I already said in answer to your question, that I think it's more promising to do this for strange metals because near the quantum critical point, conformal invariance should be a good approximation. Though if you ask some condensed matter people, they might not like this either.
But you are breaking conformal invariance.
Yes, sure. So there should be some corrections to this, of course, to begin with, because you're never at... Yeah, it is still better than the expectation that you can do it for quantum chromodynamics. Okay. So, but yeah, as I said, it's a phenomenological model. Yeah.
It appears that we live in a spatially flat, compact universe, positive conservation constant. So we need to have PS.
Oh no! In this case, we live on the boundary because I want to know how to describe the strange metal that sits in the laboratory. So that is approximate. Yeah. So it's the other direction. I agree with you that if you want to make the case for black holes, for example, and you want to know what happens to an actual black hole in our universe that evaporates, then you have the problem that we don't live in anti-Dissiter space. But that's kind of the opposite direction. Yeah, so the other thing you need to know as ingredient for what I'm about to tell you is analog gravity. To make a long story short, analog gravity tells you that perturbations in certain types of condensed matter systems propagate with an equation of motion that is analytically identical to the wave equation in curved space. So basically the background fluid in these condensed matter systems creates for you an effective metric that can describe a curved background. And what you can do then is you can, from the variables that describe the fluid, so the mass density, the pressure, and the velocity in this example, you can construct your metric, which then tells you what the space is that these perturbations travel in. The best known example is probably what UNRU calls the dump hole. So the dump hole is dumped in the same way that a black hole is black. And I put here this image that I stole from a review paper. So what you have shown here is the propagation of sound waves in a background fluid where the fluid velocity increases to the right. So if the fluid velocity is zero, then the waves just propagate outwards in concentric circles. And if the fluid velocity picks up into this direction, then the circles are kind of pulled with the fluid. And there is some position here where the speed of the fluid is identical to the speed of sound in the fluid, and this creates what is known as an acoustic horizon, and from inside this region sound waves can no longer escape outside just because the fluid is faster than the sound waves would propagate. So the effective metric that you get from that kind of system is, not so surprisingly, basically that of a black hole, and I will show you this metric later and point out an important difference. Yeah, you can understand this as some kind of a weak duality for the perturbations. So you can either think of the propagation of these modes as being in some condensed matter system or actually being in a curved space. So the equations of motion for the background in this case are the equations of motion for the fluid. They are not a priori at least, identical to the Einstein equations, because it's a different system, it's a different dynamics. Okay, so in the ADS-CFD duality, you normally have the full Einstein equations, and then you have some fields propagating on this, but there's a limit that the string theory people call the probe limit, which is basically the limit in which you have no back reaction. So in this case, you're essentially doing quantum field theory in a curved background, and that's the same thing that you are doing here as well. It's basically quantum field theory in a curved background, or actually, depending on what kind of excitation you have, it might just be normal field theory in a curved background. Okay. So what I have told you so far is that the ADS-CFT duality basically tells you, well, there are all these solutions in general relativity, some of which have a dual gauge theory. It's not all of these solutions because, at least for all we know, they need to have, for example, a negative cosmological constant. They need to have certain sources that obey certain equations of motion, so it's a subset of these. Then on the other hand, you have analog gravity, where you have all these solutions of general relativity, some of which can be described as fluids. Okay, and so the idea of analog duality is just to combine these both things and see if there is an overlap between these metrics. On the one hand, the metric that is the dual to the gauge theory on the boundary, and on the other hand, the metric that is the effective metric in the analog gravity system. And if you can show that this overlap is not empty, well, then you can basically forget about the gravitational sector to begin with, and you are left with a duality between a strongly and a weakly coupled condensed matter system. Okay, so then what you have to show is that this overlap actually is not empty, and that's what I will try to convince you of in the rest of this talk. And that's the long story. So now I'll throw equations at you until you fall asleep or I run out of time. So here are some equations. First, some more details about what they do in ADS-CMT. The gravitational system they use to model a holographic superconductor is general relativity in d plus one dimensions. Here's the curvature scalar. There's the cosmological constant. You couple this to a U1 gauge field. That's just the standard field strength tensor. Then you have a scalar propagating in this background. So the phi is a scalar. It's coupled to the U1 field. And then you have some potential, which in the simplest case is just a mass term. This coupled system gives rise to some equations of motion. Then you can make some symmetry assumptions. And you find that it has black hole solutions. And what happens here is that this coupling to the electric potential generates an effective mass term. You can basically see this just by looking at this, that destabilizes the solution with a vanishing scalar field if the field becomes too large. So at this point, you basically have this field condensing around the black hole with this charge. And the point where this transition happens is supposed to describe the transition from the normally conducting to the superconducting state. Okay, and this is the metric of the charged black holes that I used to describe the system. What you should look at here. So first, the L square is just a scale of NRD Zeta space. That's not so important. That's just there for dimensional reasons. It's related to the cosmological constant. Then this gamma is very similar to the gamma that you have with the Schwarzschild metric. This coordinate here, the coordinate Z, that's the asymptotic coordinate that has the awkward property that it is zero at the boundary. So you might be used to having coordinates that are infinity at the infinite distance. But if you are working with the ADS CFT duality, it's nicer to have a coordinate that is zero at the boundary, because then it's easier to make a coordinate expansion around it. So this 1 over z squared is then the typical scaling of anti-de-Sitter space. And the other thing that's important about this solution is that this here does not have a spherical symmetry. These are just planar subspaces. So this is why this is called a planar black hole. It is translationally invariant in all the directions perpendicular to the horizon. And these planar black holes can only exist in asymptotic anti-de-Sitter space. Yes, so if you're trying to describe a superconductor with that type of system, then of course you don't expect quantitative results. Of course, this is grossly simplified. So now I have to admit that I used to be very cynical about it. You know, I used to say, well, if it's not quantitative, but it's only qualitative, what kind of science is this? So let me show you something that at least convinced me that there must be something to it. So what you can do is, and this is a paper that's 2 years old by Horowitz and Santos, what they did here is that they used a very simple one-dimensional lattice. Okay, so calling it a lattice is maybe already saying too much. So you have a periodic system on the boundary. And then you can integrate these equation of motions that you get there inside, and then you can do your calculation in the bulk, and then you can extract some quantities of your superconductor on the boundary. And what they have calculated here is the dependence of the conductivity on the frequency for different type of temperatures above and below the transition temperature. And what you can see here is qualitatively, they all seem to scale in the same way. And the scaling goes like omega to the minus 2 over 3.
And what's the difference between the
terms? Different temperatures. So it's some, I forgot, I think some of them are above and some are below the transition temperature.
So is that just calculations on the bulk or in the bulk? Is it just bulk calculations?
The calculations are in the bulk, and then you use the ADS CFT dictionary to convert this into the quantities on the bound of the boundary theory.
Minus two-thirds? Why minus
it just comes out of the calculation. They don't really know why, so it's a numerical calculation. Okay, so here's the data. Okay, which is from some actual condensed matter paper, and they're plotting exactly the same quantity. So that's the conductivity, and this is the frequency here for underdoped and overdoped things. Don't ask me exactly which superconductor it was. Doesn't really matter. So the point is that they all seem to show exactly the same universal scaling. And I find this very, very interesting because the model that they used was so dramatically oversimplified. I mean, you have this one-dimensional potential that you use there. And these superconductors have very, very complicated multi-layered lattice symmetries. So it's not getting anywhere close by. But still, this clearly seems to capture something of the truth there. Yeah, it's the same, you know. So as well as you can fit it to the data. Okay, so here's some more details about analog gravity. So this is the effective analog metric that you get in the non-relativistic case. And yeah, I should probably warn you that some days ago I got a referee report on this paper, and it says that the paper's full with sign mistakes. So don't trust me on the signs. They might be right or they might be wrong. So here's the metric. The important thing to note here is that the subspaces are flat. So these are the spatial subspaces. And then you have in the space-time coordinates, you get the velocity that mixes these two things. And then you have a prefactor that with a power that depends on the number of dimensions. The reason this comes about is that if you derive the wave equation, what you actually extract there is the inverse metric. And then if you want to get the metric, you have to first take the determinant, and then the determinant depends on the number of dimensions. So this is why you get the strange power here. So what do you do then if you want to know whether a metric can be described as an analog metric? Well, you have to try to rewrite your metric into this form. This will not in generally be possible. It's something like a gauge condition. Then you read off the degrees of freedom, the rho and the v. And then you have to check that these degrees of freedom actually fulfill the fluid's equation of motion. So the Euler equation and the continuity equation, or in this case, the non-relativistic limit of these. And again, this will not generally be the case. Here's again the Schwarzschild black hole. So that's the best known case probably that people have looked at. If you take the normal Schwarzschild black hole in your standard coordinates that you've all seen a million times, then you can make a coordinate transformation to convert it into this form. This is called the Penleve-Gulstrat coordinates. What you do here is basically that you make the spatial subspaces flat, and then you rotate these prefactors into the time-space mixing coordinates. So you get here a mixing term between the space and the time coordinates. And now you have brought it into the form of the analog metric that I showed you previously. Then you can go and read off the quantities. So you have a speed of sound that is constant. Actually should not be one, because then it would mean it's the same as the speed of light, but I have something to say about this later. You have the rho is also constant, and this prefactor here just gives you the velocity. So then you can calculate the rho times v, and then you have to check whether the continuity equation is fulfilled. So the continuity equation has a part that is a derivative with respect to the time, and that is trivially zero because it's a static case. And then you still have the gradient, and actually, I'm sorry, this is wrong. It should be a gradient, not the partial derivative. This is exactly what it should not be. So what you're left with from the continuity equation is that the gradient of rho times v should vanish. So now this is spherical symmetry. So you have this gradient in spherical coordinates, and then you know that this will only vanish if this goes with 1 over r squared. Yes. You're right. It's the divergent. It's the dot product between the vectors, right? So that's the divergence. Yeah.
What is gamma?
The gamma is the normal gamma from the Schwarzschild black hole. So it's 1 minus 2m over r. Yeah, sorry about this. Okay, so all of this is just to say that this metric, if you convert it into a fluid, so to say, it does not fulfill the continuity equation. So it cannot actually be described by a realistic fluid. So now you might be confused because people, some of whom in the audience have actually done this in the laboratory. So what do they do there? Well, they do not take exactly this metric, but they introduce a conformal prefactor, and you can then choose the prefactor so that the continuity equation is fulfilled. And if you're only interested in the propagation of modes in this background, then this conformal prefactor doesn't really disturb you all that much, because it just changes the overall scaling of these modes, and you can then adjust for this analytically. Okay, so this is all well and fine, but it is clearly unsatisfactory for this idea of a duality. Then, on the other hand, we are not dealing with black holes in asymptotic Minkowski space, but in asymptotic de Sitter space. Okay, so now we'll have to try to do the same thing with the black holes in asymptotic Anna de Sitter space. But before we look at this, we first have to look at anti-Anna de Sitter space. And I didn't know anything about this until a year ago. And then I was trying to figure out, you know, as somebody thought of doing anti-Anna de Sitter space, and asked several people about this, and in the end, somebody showed me a paper where they had done a general Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time in the fully relativistic case, and it was terribly complicated. And I got really scared because, I was thinking, if the empty space case is so complicated, what do I do with the damn charged black holes? Okay, and then I talked to Silke at some point, and I don't know if you even noticed this, but you said at some point, well, if it's conformally flat, you can always do it. And I thought, well, but anti-Sitter space is conformally flat, right? Okay, so the thing is that you just have to use the coordinates where it is conformally flat, and then it's really trivial. You can just read it off. So I have no idea why these guys in the paper use such a terribly complicated coordinate system. But, to be honest, it is an awkward coordinate system that you would not normally use. If you think of it, from the Friedman-Robertson-Walker perspective, why would you choose these coordinates?
Could it be because it doesn't cover the whole
time? Yeah, sure. But as I said, they were looking at the Friedman-Robertson-Walker case more generally, and then you don't even think of this problem, right? So what you do here then is that you can immediately read off the density, which goes with scales with 1 over z square. Then the off-diagonal elements are just 0. And the speed of sound is still constant. So now I have to say 1-2 words about this speed of sound, which, as I said, it should not be 1, because 1 is the speed of light, right? But the thing is that this analogy is not generally covariant in the following sense, that you could change the coordinates of this analog metric without at the same time changing the coordinates in your actual laboratory, because you have a freedom in how to construct this metric. So what you can do here is that you rescale this time coordinate. And if you had at the same time also to rescale the time coordinate in your laboratory, then of course this would just be totally empty rescaling. But since it's not generally covariant in the sense that I just told you, what you can do in this way is to basically set the speed of sound to any constant that you can then choose to fit whatever your model has. Okay, so all this is just to convince you that this is C equals 1 is pretty much meaningless. Okay, so you can do anti-Anna de Sitter space. Now, what about the ADS planar black hole? So what we can do here is exactly the same thing that was done for the Schwarzschild black hole, which is that you take the metric that you have and you rotate out you make a coordinate transformation which you require that the spatial subspaces are flat on the expenses of introducing a mixing between the spatial spaces and the time coordinate. Works exactly the same way as it does for the Payne-Levy-Gulstrap coordinates in the Schwarzschild black case. Then you get this mixing factor here between the T and the Z coordinate. And then you can go and read off again the quantities of the fluid as we have done previously.
Sorry. Yeah. Assuming a fluid, so that continuity equation, we usually write the continuity equation has pressure in it.
No, the Euler equation has pressure in it, right?
No, the continuity equation has pressure in it as well.
It's a continuity equation. Yeah. But actually, my question is, how can the density be a function of z while the speed of sound is constant? Is that, isn't this kind
So you can calculate the pressure from this. I didn't do it because it doesn't give you an extra constraint.
Okay, what am I missing? So I mean, the constraint equation is rho dot plus rho plus p divergence of velocity is there. So pressure isn't there. And I'm not thinking you can get rid of
it. You're making a sure that it's incompressible, and then you write p pressure can be written as c squared over rho, or c squared as proportional dp, the pressure on your function of the density, so it's dp to rho.
This is the non-relativistic case. Yes, so there are several assumptions that go in there that I kind of wiped onto the carpet, which is, for example, that it's non-compressible, and it is what's it called? The rotation of the velocity field is zero, and there might be something else. The density depends on the.
I don't know, I just don't see how you have this density, density is a function of a coordinate, so it's not constant.
That's right. Yeah. The density is not constant,
but
yeah.
Then I think that c is not constant.
Yeah.
And also this whole argument about continuity.
It depends on the system. So you do need a pressure on the system. You can calculate the pressure, but I don't have it here.
But the question, where do you get that divergence of rho v equals to zero? Then where does that come from? I don't.
The divergent.
Yeah.
This is the continuity equation.
That's only continuity equation.
This is what is left of the continuity equation. So, okay, beat me. So the continuity equation, you know. So in the relativistic case, both the continuity equation and the Euler equation are basically the conservation of the stress energy tensor.
Okay, and this is not an incompressible fluid.
No.
It's not okay.
It's a non-relativistic.
So it's just a problem of time.
Yes, and it's the zero equation of d mu t mu nu,
right.
Then you take one zero, and then you have the rho is the zero zero component, right? And
I think I understand. So I guess the thing is you then set c to be a constant by hand, right?
No, this is what you read off there.
Right. So from the c and rho, you can read off pressure. Is that the idea?
Yes, and this, if you have the C and the rho and the B, then you use the other three equations, which have the pressure on the other side, basically. So you have some force on the other side normally, and the force is the gradient of the pressure field. This, you can just calculate it. I don't have it here because it doesn't give you an extra constraint on the system. It just tells you what's the force that you need to get the pressure and the rho right. Yes?
This is the black hole case. But if you go back to the empty one, what is the fluid actually doing? Maybe it's in there, but I didn't get it. Is it flowing or is it?
No, it's not flowing. It's yeah, it's under pressure. Yes. And I forgot it goes with.
So you have some external force that's holding. I mean, if the pressure gradient is not zero, then you would expect the fluid to flow. So why is it not flowing? Is there some sort of gravitational field that's holding it? You know what I mean? Some external. If you actually wanted to build
I mean, I have a counterexample to what you just said. If I take a fluid and look at sound waves, and if I include gravitational.
Yes, that's right.
So it's still at rest, but the speed of sound is gets an imaginary component.
No, I agree. That's why I asked if you implicitly have some gravitational field that's holding the fluid.
place. Possibly. So can I just finish this because I'm running out of time? So the thing is, what I'm trying to tell you is that you can read off these degrees of freedom of the fluid, and they fulfill all the equations that they should fulfill. Now, what the system in reality looks like, I don't know. Okay. So to come back to the black hole case, so you make the same exercise that you did with the Schwarzschild black hole, and you find that in this case, the continuity equation is fulfilled if and only if the boundary has 3+1 dimensions. Okay, and in this case, it is really identically fulfilled. You do not have to introduce an additional conformal prefactor. That, I think, is interesting. So now you have to ask, of course, well, where does the analog gravity system live? So there's another constraint here that comes in, which comes from the scaling of the acoustic metric. I told you that it has a prefactor that depends on the number of dimensions. So if you want the scaling to work out correctly, you can from this read off the dimension of space in which the acoustic metric has to live, which is also 3+1 dimensions. So what this tells you is that the analog gravity system lives on a slice of anti-de Sitter space, which is perpendicular to the horizon, whereas the strongly coupled gauge theory lives on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, which is parallel to the horizon. But both systems both have to be 3+1 dimensional. And this is not something that I tell you should be so, because we live in 3+1 dimensions, because this only works in 3+1 dimensions. And you also need the asymptotic anti-de Sitter space, because the planar symmetry is relevant to make this equation come out correctly. Okay, so and now I've pretty much run out of time. The next question is then, of course, can you still do it for the charge case? And the quick answer is, yes, you can do it, but it's not really trivial to see. The problem is that the way that you normally identify the velocity in the acoustic metric does not work anymore, because in all the places where you previously had the velocity, you now have an additional coupling term to the current that comes from the gauge covariant derivative. So if you want to correctly identify the physical degrees of freedom of the fluid, to then check whether the equations are fulfilled, you first have to rederive the acoustic metric with a coupling to the U1 field. And you can do this. It takes a little time. The short story of what comes out then is, okay, so you take your Lagrangian, you make the minimal coupling, then you derive the equations of motion for the background field. You know what the U1 field has to be, because you know this from the ADS system that they used. So you know what the field is. Then you use the Maxwell's equations, so the dressed Maxwell equations that come out from this Lagrangian. This gives you the coupling between A and the current. And then you can rederive the velocity, how it appears in the metric. And it turns out that it is related to the expression that appeared in the metric in this particular form. So you have to divide all of these quantities that appear in the metric by 1 minus j times a, which is just this coupling factor. The reason that it appears in the denominator is that this thing has to be normalized to 1. Okay, so it's a 4 velocity. Okay, so now there's the question, what does this factor turn out to be? Well, we already know that this can only work if the anti-de Sitter space is 4+1 dimensional, because the uncharged case only worked in 4+1 dimensions. And that simplifies this expression, because this prefactor is just a constant. And then it turns out that these both factors that appear here are proportional to each other with a power of the asymptotic coordinate, that is z to the 4. And when you now go and extract finally the physical velocity, it still scales as z to the 2, which is exactly the same that you had in the uncharged case, and the continuity equation is still fulfilled. So after you do all this exercise, what you find is that if you take into account the gauge covariant derivative properly, that these additional factors just all fall out, and it gives you exactly the same result as you had for the uncharged case. And I find this remarkable because there was a priori no reason for this to work out this way. This additional term that you have in the gamma comes from the solution of the Einstein equations with the source given by the gauge field. And there was no reason for this to be the same thing as this particular coupling. So once you have this, you can then identify some quantities from the one system with the other system. So there are a lot of dimensional constants here that I have omitted that you can then go on and identify. The simplest thing maybe that you can extract from this is that the temperature of the system on the boundary must be related to the speed of sound in the fluid. That's because the temperature of the system on the boundary is related to the position of the horizon in the gravitational system, and the position of the horizon in the system, on the other hand, is related to the speed of sound in the analog gravity system. Okay, good. And here's a sketch of this.
Have you made a particular gauge choice there?
For what? For the metric? Yeah.
For the electromagnetic, for the vector potential?
No.
Because you had a...
Oh, yes, because you have to do this already in the, because of this constant you're asking that appears here, this constant. This is fixed from the chemical potential on the boundary theory. So sorry if I hate this if people do this in a talk, this skipping back. Okay, so here it is. Okay, so this is already a gauge choice, right? Where does this constant come from? The constant comes in here because on the boundary, this has to go to mu, which is the chemical potential in the boundary theory. So this, yes, it is a gauge choice. And this is important, actually. If you don't do this, it doesn't come out right. So this is peculiar. So another way to say this is that if I hadn't known this particular gauge from the ADS-CFT people, this would not have worked out. Okay, so here's the sketch of this. I've already told you this. So basically the idea is you have your strongly coupled condensed matter system on the boundary. The ADS-CMT duality relates this to a gravitational theory in asymptotical anti-de-Sitter space. You project this onto a subspace. So if the system is translationally invariant, this projection is pretty much meaningless. Then this subspace has the same dimension as the system on the boundary, and this new duality is the relation between the both. Okay, so here's the fine print. This does not take into account back reaction, of course. Have to spell this out. You would only say that this is a real duality if you can do it on the level of the equations of motion, which I have not done. I've only done it for the perturbation, in which case both is essentially quantum field theory in a curved background. But another, maybe a more optimistic way to look at it is to say that this is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for this duality to exist. And it's only the non-relativistic limit. There's a priori nothing wrong with using the non-relativistic limit, but I would think that if there's really some duality here, then there must be a relativistic completion. Oh yes, then I didn't actually talk about quantum fields, but classical fields, so one would have to do it for quantum fields. There must be some degrees of freedom getting lost because of the projection. The Euler equation, this came up before, do not give an additional constraint. They tell you what the pressure has to be or what the force field is, or if you look at the Lagrangian approach, what is the right potential that gives you the force that has to be on the other side of the equation. Yes, and then in the ADS case, you have a massive scalar field coupled to the U1 field, so you have to make sure that you can actually get the mass, and the answer is that yes, you can get it. Okay, so and it's not actually that difficult. What's it good for? I'm almost done. Well, to begin with, this maps the problematic strongly coupled system on the boundary to yet another system, which is a weakly coupled condensed matter system. So that gives you another set of equations that might be easier to solve or maybe not. I don't know. But at least it's a new method to solve them. What I find more interesting is that both of these systems can be realized in the laboratory, so you know, at least in principle. So in the one case, you have your superconductor that sits in the laboratory over there. In the other case, you have whatever system simulates your acoustic metric. And now you can measure things here and you can measure things there. And then by the dictionary that you can read off from this duality, you can see whether they match. So why is this interesting? It's interesting because in the derivation of this relation between the both system, you implicitly assume that this ADS-CMT duality is valid. So you can, in principle, read off from the comparison between these both system whether this actually worked. Okay. And that's it. I think that this could be the first evidence for a new duality between strongly and weakly coupled condensed matter systems. Thank you for your attention.
So when you say fluctuations on the boundary, you really, if I take a fluid, right, and I have a free surface, then of course I have like surface waves in the boundary and I have sound waves in the bulk. And of course they are coupled in general. Just usually what people assume is that there's no gravitational force acting on the fluid, and so really the speed of sound is just constant in an incompressible fluid. So is this what you're looking at, like ripples on the surface? Well, what are the perturbations
on the boundary? It doesn't have to be a surface wave. It's just some density, you know, some sound wave. Could be
and
a bulk wave.
You want to compare things on the boundary with the bulk. And what are these fluctuations on the
boundary? No. It's not on the boundary of the analog gravity system. It's on the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. But this space doesn't really exist, right? It's a mental construct, so to say, in this case. You have two physical systems that are the condensed matter system that gives rise effectively to this acoustic metric, and then the other system that you have is the strongly coupled condensed matter systems or system of ADS-CFT. But it's not like this system lives on the boundary of this system. This lives on the boundary of the full space, and this lives on a slice of the space.
Maybe I missed it, but are you able to correspond particular observables to each of the two?
In some simple cases, so one could definitely extend this approach to calculate more complicated observables, but I just haven't done it. But what I can read off from this immediately, basically, is what I mentioned, there has to be a relation between the temperature on the boundary and the speed of sound in the other system. And the other thing is that it's stuck somewhere in the constants that I didn't write down, is the relation between the chemical potential on the boundary and the charge that creates the field in the other system.
But let's take either of those. Let's take the relationship between the temperature and the speed of sound. Those are each functions of thermodynamic state variables of each of the systems. What kind of relationship do you have?
Well, in the simplest case, they're just constants. So, I mean.
But given one constant and another constant, there's a relationship between them. You just go from this one to this one. That's not something you can tell.
That's not something,
I mean, if you. Is there a relationship between if you vary the temperature over here, then you predict that the speed of sound will vary here?
Yeah, basically.
But how do you test that?
Well, you could test. So maybe that's a stupid thing to test. That's right. You need a functional relation between two different things, and then see if they come out as you predict they would be.
Right.
Yeah.
So
agree
with
this.
So with more work, could you dig something like that out?
Huh?
With more work, could you dig out a functional
relation? Yeah, with more work, with more money, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it probably already answered this question. What's the future? What can you get results in this by applying this law of gravity to such that you can compare with experimental data and contains some matter of physics? Can you improve our understanding of high temperature superconductors?
In the most optimistic case, yes. So as I said, you would have to get the case with back reaction done. So let us imagine for a moment you could do this. What this would tell you is that you can convert the strongly coupled theory that describes your superconductor into a weakly coupled theory. So you basically have a better tractable description of a complicated system. So yes, certainly, that could dramatically improve our understanding of strange metals and high-temperature superconductors, in the best of all worlds.
So
I guess I'm a skeptical because we already know that interactions of sound waves don't obey equivalence principle because, another word is that, Euler equations are not the same as Einstein equations. So, and to actually push the duality, to actually do something non-trivial, because you need interactions, and we know interactions of fluid don't have coherence. So you need to find some sort of fluid that somehow interactions have the same symmetry that the free theory has.
Yeah.
But that could be the main challenge, to find a fluid that does that.
It's certainly, in the most general case, it can't work just because you don't have sufficiently many degrees of freedom. But it is possible that you have a system with sufficiently many symmetries so that these equations just come out to be the same.
So you're hopeful that there is a fluid out there that its fluid equations are identical to Einstein equations?
Yep.
Okay. So good.
The only thing, what worries me a bit is, because you're assuming this particular function for the pressure, right? That you, when in fluid dynamics, you have three equations. You have the continuity, the Euler, and the equation of state. And that you haven't taken into account because when you...
Well, it's implicit in the Lagrangian kind of. Right?
I just give an example where I think you have not... there is when you want to, instead of looking at pure sound waves, you say, wait a second, what if I don't neglect the effects of gravity? So, which has a different function as you wrote down, but that's an example. How will the speed of sound change? So what happens if speed of sound then, moves in a fluid where the density is changing? And in fact, depending on which direction you're going, you can actually have, you get a complex frequency. So you can have damping or enhancement of the sound waves. So, and because even if it's a different behavior, if you have a sound wave moving in a fluid with densities changing, you should have a mechanism like that. And if you were consistently changing your equation of state, equation of state would include, I would expect you to get more complicated physics coming out. But that's just a guess of mine, which I would think, I mean, it should be there. Maybe I'm wrong, but just from my intuition, I would expect similar behavior.
So I don't know if these systems actually physically exist. I don't really know if you start from a Lagrangian approach, how you can even get something that is inconsistent in itself. But the Lagrangian that I've used is a fairly general class of Lagrangians. So I'm kind of hoping that somewhere in this class of Lagrangians might be something that you can actually do in the laboratory.
Can you just summarize again? It's a duality on between two condensed matter systems. If in the end you can throw away the ADS, that was just an intermediate step. So what are the two systems? One was a superconductor, and the other one, it had a non-relativistic version, I guess, which you showed us, and then there's a conjectural relativistic version, is that right?
Yes, that was correct. So you have on the boundary, you have the strongly coupled system, which you need to be strongly coupled so that the gravity is weakly coupled. And then on the analog gravity system is weakly coupled. It has quasi-particle excitations.
So what should we think of it? Just a perfect fluid or fluid with viscosity, or
no, it doesn't have viscosity.
So it's a perfect.
At least, yeah. So at least in this approximation, it does not have. Yes. So yeah. What was that the question?
Yeah. That was just a non-relativistic version.
Yes, and I think there has to be a relativistic completion.
Would still be a perfect fluid. So it's just. Its variables are just the density, the velocity.
Yes, so that's the same thing. That's kind of the standard thing that they do in the analog gravity literature. So
then you have an equation of states.
There is some equation of state that has to be of a particular form, but otherwise is not really specified. It's kind of implicit in the speed of sound.
Should it be more than that? Because you need to have a graviton. So there must be some degree of breakdown which is not density.
Yes, but this situation that I looked at is very highly constrained by the number of symmetries, right? You have this planar symmetry, and you do not really expect that to be the full number of degrees of freedom. So the question is, what is left of the spin 2 field if you have sufficiently many symmetries?
When you say relativistic, you actually want the full Einstein plus fluid equations for your dual system? I mean, on the one side, there's the superconductor or whatever, and then the other side, there's the perfect fluid. Do you want that to include gravity?
What I mean with the relativistic completion is that in the in the fully relativistic limit, the analog metric has a more complicated form. There are terms in V square that are neglected in this expression.
But it's a fluid living in flat space, is that right?
Yes, it lives in flat space.
But it can allow high velocities.
Yes, and this is always relative to the speed of sound, so not the speed of light. I always get confused about this. If I see C, I always think
when
it's
you say relativistic. Now I'm. When you say relativistic, do you mean the speed? You mean really relativistic speeds relative to the speed of light? Or
no, the speed of sound.
Relativity that.
Relative to the speed of sound.
So why should it be relativistic? The superconductor is not relativistic. And why should the analog system be Lorentz invariant with some fake Lorentz group that has to do with the speed of sound?
It doesn't have to. I'm just saying that I would expect this completion to exist.
But I think there's also the other fluids, like superfluids, and if you take a fluid made out of photons, then people have relativistic VOCs and so on, and there it's not about the whole thing flying with extremely high speed, it's just about that the system perhaps is marked going to describe that. So I'm not sure, depending on which fluids you're looking at, right? So
yeah, I mean it could have, but Zabina seemed to think that it should have or something. That's what I'm not understanding.
No, but you can
it could happen that a particular
right?
one shows relativistic behavior in some regime, but that doesn't seem to be a necessary part of the duality. That's what I'm not understanding.
There is a priori nothing wrong with working with the non-relativistic limit. Let me put it this way. I've massaged these metrics to try to get them into the right form, and I think you can do it with the relativistic completion. It's just more complicated.
Okay. I think that's good enough for discussion. Shall we thank Sabine again?